My mother's death forced the blindfolds, any blindfolds that I may have had against injustice, off my eyes. And for me, having written my own story taught me that I was stronger than I know. Writing this story, I think, helped me deepen that sense that I need to keep facing the hard things if I want to feel as if I'm a full human being in the world. And I've been an activist for a long time, and I feel like facing the hard stuff is a way of deepening my activism. By facing really painful stories, we can start to, when we break silences, that's how things will change. I think, you know, Justice Brandeis, who I have no relationship to, said the greatest disinfectant is sunshine. When we shed light on painful stuff, that's when we can change it.
Yeah, there was another interview I read that you did. You weren't interviewing yourself. You actually had somebody asking you questions. And they asked, what's the best writing advice you ever got? And you said it was somebody told you to write about the things that scare you.
Yes, and I think that's so important. That's where the real juice is. And I think that when we write about the things that scare us, we can embrace our full humanity more deeply, and we can start to release those things that we're afraid of as well if we face them head on.
Well, Gail, again, thanks so much for joining us at KVU.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Gail Brandeis, author of the new book, Many Restless Concerns, The Victims of Countess Bathory Speak in Chorus, from Black Lawrence Press. You can find out more on her website, gailbrandeis.com. This is Ken Jones for KVU's News in Depth.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up next, is Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Joining me, as always, is
Elliot Gilland.
Elliot, thank you for being here.
Yeah, in these crazy times.
Yeah, we're coming to you from inside the quarantine zone here.
Yeah.
Beautiful Portland, Oregon, where it's sunny outside, but no one's allowed to go outside yet.
Yes.
So, for everyone listening out there, we're going to take the entire episode, you know, all 30 minutes of this, and discuss the biggest current event that's happening right now, which is the global pandemic. Talking about, of course, coronavirus and the spread throughout this country and around the world, and how that affects working people specifically. So we're going to dive right in. As everyone listening is probably aware, if you aren't aware, you should definitely turn on the news and take a look and see what's going on in the world right now, because everyone is being asked to stay at home, distance themselves from other people. And, you know, for those workers who can work from home or work, you know, away from other people is what is being asked. But we're, you know, so we're going to talk a little bit about that, but more specifically, we're going to talk about the people who maybe cannot do that, whose jobs are not allowing them to distance themselves from people, specifically like service workers and things like that. But yeah, so starting off, you know, there have been a number of, you know, obviously we've seen the global economy starting to take a hit from this.
Well, funnily enough, I think it all kind of came together from the NBA. I think a lot of Americans were kind of aware of it. And obviously it was kind of something that was off to the side. And once Rudy Gobert tested positive for COVID-19, and that started basically a shutdown of the NBA, and then following that, all of the sports leagues following suit, closing down, I think that's what kind of brought it to the forefront of at least the discussion and kind of, calling for states of emergencies outside of, like, Washington State and stuff.
Yeah. It's pretty telling that's sort of like the...
Yes, that is the...
Yeah, the canary in the coal mine of this country, the thing that people pay most attention to would be the sports.
Yes.
And I remember hearing the first I sort of began thinking about this in terms of how the long-term effects it might have on this country was the discussion around March Madness and how they were considering playing the games without fans in the arena. Mm-hmm. And just the sort of weird dystopian vision of what... You know, March Madness usually being a situation where there's really rabid fans and great student sections and just like raucous arenas, and seeing that level of competition happening in a completely silent, empty arena would be
very strange.
Yeah, like kind of very fitting for this weird late stage capitalism that we're living in right now. But yeah, I think exactly like you said. Obviously, the Wall Street was experiencing, the stock market was experiencing tumult. As a result of a lot of things, and then it started to peak around what we were seeing happening in Italy and in China.
Yeah.
Things were there was definitely downturns, but it really wasn't until the NBA and then quickly all the other sports leagues, MLB,
yes,
and NFL, and NHL suspended their seasons or pushed them back that really we started to see this just precipitous drop in the stock market, and then also other companies choosing to shutter and sort of the reality of the situation,
yeah,
setting in for Americans.
Yeah, and companies starting to try to cut costs too. I think one of the really nice pieces of discussion that went on, especially on Twitter, but kind of across the internet, was about all of the in-house stadium workers,
right,
who work for all of these sports teams, and kind of what they were going to do in the event of no games taking place. I think it was funny that a lot of players and organizations stepped up to pay their salaries and the owners did not.
Right.
I think we'll talk about it more, but I think a theme here is kind of bare minimum of, what companies are willing to do for kind of gig workers or, kind of on-site kind of blue-collar workers is, it's the bare minimum is what they're willing to do.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah.
Really, the theme of the last week and everything we've been seeing surrounding this is kind of the stark dichotomy between the lack of any will to provide for the people from those who, do have the most power and do have the most wealth and the ability to make, to make real meaningful adjustments to help people versus the everyday person or those in lesser positions of power, mm-hmm, stepping up and really the social solidarity that does exist. Among largely the 99%, for lack of a better term, versus the complete detachment that we've seen from the people in the highest positions.
Yeah.
I think building off of that, the act of social solidarity that is everyone choosing to stay home and completely upend their lives in order to save, even if thus far the evidence shows that most people under the age of 50, as long as they are, without any sort of immune deficiencies or any sort of health issues, are likely not to suffer severe consequences from receiving this or from catching this virus.
Yeah.
Still, people are choosing to stay home and are because they realize, if I go out into the world, if I go to this workplace, if I go to this crowded restaurant, I could be a vector to infect someone who is, maybe older than me or sicker than me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the act of just social solidarity of staying home is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, I think, and the term you people have probably seen and heard is flattening the curve.
Yeah.
Which basically, for anyone who doesn't know what that means, is basically kind of flattening the curve of kind of time and outbreak, So basically, instead of having a really high peak in terms of people who are infected and overloading the healthcare system, it's kind of spreading that out over a shorter amount of time and less people by, doing all the things that everyone has heard about, social distancing, coughing, not into your hands, all that kind of thing. And I think it is really important right now just for everyone to stay safe is to really kind of think about the places that you're getting your information and make sure while I do believe there is a lot of good stuff out there, I think, like the Alex Joneses of the world and kind of these types of people are spreading a lot of misinformation.
Yes.
So you want to make sure that you are, one, kind of listening to the CDC and the WHO and trying to figure out what is best for you and your family, and making sure as well that if you see conversations or are listening to family members who are spreading information that is not accurate about COVID-19, that you make sure you talk to them about it and make sure that they are also kind of looking at the correct situations. It is kind of unfortunate that we can't look to our president in times like this where he's not really actually discussing the real issues that are at hand. You know, I think it's important to make sure that you're kind of looking to the CDC and these kind of organizations to make sure that you have a really good grasp of what's actually occurring.
Yeah. I mean, up until basically the day after all sports leagues shut down and it became very real, our president was referring to this as a Democrat hoax, you know?
Yeah.
And it will be interesting to see, because obviously things have shifted in the last few days, but the vast majority of coverage around this, you know, on a station like Fox News has been downplaying it and just complete obfuscation of the reality of this. And, you know, if you look at just the general viewership of a station like Fox News, mm-hmm. it tends to be older people and people who tend to be more risk of catching this and having severe impacts from this. So, you know, if that continues, that level of sort of misinformation or downplaying of the crisis continues, it will be interesting to see if you can track clusters of, you know, this spreading based on whether or not, you know, like high viewership rates of Fox News versus other news channels or, yeah. you know, how that works. So that'll be something that, you know, obviously we'll see in the future, we'll be able to look at in the future, but it will be interesting to see how that direct misinformation coming from certain sources and media sources may directly impact the health outcomes of portions of our population.
Mm-hmm.
It has been a very, I think, eye-opening time.
And yeah.
Potentially a radicalizing time for this country and for the people of this country, you know, just seeing how, you know, essentially ill-prepared our society and our institutions are
yes.
to handle something as, I mean, obviously this is a mass widespread issue, but it is a relatively simple thing that is like, this is a health concern that yeah. needs to be dealt with in certain ways. And yet we are seeing a breakdown of a lot of functions of society and we're seeing the cracks show. And just sort of extrapolating out from this, if this is how ill-prepared we are to handle this individual, like, pandemic, imagine what happens when we have larger-scale issues as a result of climate change, you know, mass migration, mm-hmm. also, you know, spreading of different viruses and things like that, the loss of certain inhabitable areas. Like, if we are unable to handle this at this moment, moving forward, how does this system better prepare itself to handle what we know is going to be coming in the next century, you know, half century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, and how it affects kind of the backbone of all of the things that we need as a capitalist society to happen. And so that, to me, kind of takes it back to workers and obviously the focus of this show. And so I think you've seen a lot of news, especially around paid sick leave, about when it is and isn't offered. But I think we're seeing a lot of, one, you know, people who can work from home are. But, you know, a lot of people don't have that option.
Right.
And kind of how is the government and how are individual companies kind of dealing with that and making sure that they're moving forward in the best manner. And I think in a lot of cases, they aren't. Like, for example, I think we've seen kind of throughout this that kind of delivery food, you know, your Uber Eats, your DoorDashes, basically are seeing a, you know, an increase in requests and deliveries. And it's really these kind of like communal, I'm blanking on the word, but like basically these kind of companies that are all based on, you know, people using their own cars and delivering,
yeah.
you know, services on their own, you know, like a Uber or an Uber Eats. I think you're seeing how ill-prepared these industries are for something of this nature. For example, there is no kind of standard policy in place for individual DoorDash employees or contractors at restaurants being able to wash their hands or be able to use the bathroom at all.
Right.
In some cases, they aren't allowed to. Now, that's not in every single restaurant, but I think things of this nature are causing lots of questions to kind of to pop up. And you'll see, too, I mean, you're seeing stories online, too, of, you know, people ordering off Instacart or different these other things, and the data hasn't been kind of set up properly, so they order stuff that doesn't come because the store they ordered from is actually out.
Right.
And then these people are upset and they're not tipping or doing these different things mm-hmm. that they normally would do. So I've seen lots of stories around kind of just general breakdown of these employees who cannot work from home because their job does not allow them to. And they're kind of being forced into these really poor situations because there's still business to be had.
Right. I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, obviously just the overall situation of like these contract situations for workers, you know, what we've seen largely in the quote unquote sharing economy is not prepared. It's completely ill-prepared to deal with this. But even more specifically, like as we see in cities across the country, you know, they're shutting down restaurants and bars except for delivery. There is no plan that I'm hearing about being implemented for exactly what you said. You know, these people who now are going to be the sole source of food, you know, for most, you know, delivering food to most of the people, there is no situation set up for them to make sure they're washing their hands properly when they are receiving the food and transferring to people. So if they maybe come in contact with one, you know, client that they're delivering food to who may have this and they, you know, if it does transfer to them, if they're not having a proper way of cleaning their hands, washing their hands before they go get the next person's food, they could be transferring that to either the restaurant they're going to or to the next person they deliver it to. You know, it's a situation that because we have this entire sector of the economy is set up around, hey, it's on you. Like, everything is up to you, the individual. We as the company that is setting this up and providing for you, or, you know, that is arranging this for you, is not going to have any responsibility, not providing any system in place to take care of this on a larger scale. We're now seeing, you know, because Purell is $500 in the store and there's no wipes or you know, soap and things like that, on an individual basis, people are not able to handle this alone. And yet, one of the main sources of food being, you know, provided to our society is based on these individuals who don't have a system in place to make sure they are staying clean.
Yeah.
And therefore, that could be a larger... This could become, as people stay home and have more food delivered.
And I think both unions and companies were kind of unprepared for this. I mean, I have trouble seeing, like, you know, in some sort of collectively bargained situation. Obviously, this isn't because, you know, DoorDash employees are all contractors. But,
right.
you know, in other, you know, maybe factory type settings where there is a collectively bargained kind of deal, I have a tough time imagining that there's legalese in place for an event such as this.
Right.
And I think that's when you come back to the paid sick leave and, you know, all these other things where there are people who are not able to, you know, just join a WebEx at home and to continue working as usual, who are being put into these situations that are just really not ideal. And I think in a lot of cases, probably opening them up to more a greater likelihood of spreading the virus.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, this really is drawing a stark contrast within our working economy of people who work jobs that are able to work remote, work from home, and those jobs that are increasingly, we're realizing, essential to the functioning of our society that cannot work from home, that have to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, that's one issue that I think is, although obviously it is, we're still in a crisis, that is a positive thing that has come out of this that I think, you know, we're realizing like the unsung heroes that exist in daily life. You know, people like the grocery store workers who are essentially, you know, and they're working crazy hours and, you know, they're stocking shelves at 2 a.m, but they're out there essentially as frontline employees and coming in contact with a large swath of the population every single day to make sure that there is food available for the people who are now being forced to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, you have people like garbage pickers, you know, mail carriers, delivery workers, hospital workers, you know, people like that, the ones that are making sure that are doing jobs that you don't see or think about on a day-to-day basis. They're not glorified jobs. They're not ones that anyone is particularly excited about. But they are 100% essential to making sure that this whole situation, this whole society we have does not fall apart And so they are the ones out there doing this work day to day, making sure that we can stay at home and be safe.
Yeah.
And there is a growing movement and a growing discussion around the concept of maybe giving people like that, like specifically grocery workers and delivery workers, something akin to hazard pay.
Yeah.
Because they are, in fact, you know, sometimes they're working for less than $15 an hour, you know.
But or UBI.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Universal basic income, mm-hmm. Yeah, has been, I think, a really big topic that has been going around as well. And I think, you know, generally this is a more kind of leftist progressive show.
Yes.
And I think people tend to be surprised when a lot of leftists were not fans of Andrew Yang. And the UBI, because I think it's generally known as kind of a progressive position to hold.
Right.
But I think I, you know, me and I would assume you as well, mm-hmm. I think have a pretty skeptical view of it, not because of the general basis behind it, because I think as we move forward into, like you said, this late stage capitalism type environment,
yeah.
it's going to have to be created in some form or another as right. people are unable to live as their jobs get automation and such like
yeah.
that. So, but a lot of times UBI is used as a way to actually, you know, destroy the welfare state. And basically they want to start giving UBI so that, you know, in the marketplace of ideas, you can solve your problems with $1,000 instead of having these social programs that are designed to help you.
Right.
So I think it's, again, I think it's important when we're having these conversations to understand where the money's coming from.
Absolutely.
And not just that it would be coming. So
yeah.
it kind of, again, it goes along those lines of like the misinformation or why someone might be interested in something like UBI
yeah.
as opposed to, you know, having welfare programs, which have helped so many people, you know, over the last 100 years. So,
yeah. And UBI, like exactly like you're saying, it is really the context in which it exists. You know, what we're seeing right now, like it would be an essential tool to be used in the fight against heading into a depression in this moment. But it has to come with other elements. If it's just a substitute for, okay, you're losing your job and we're not going to provide anything for you and there probably won't be enough of a job market existing in the future, so you get $1,000 and that's it.
It's basically like at the end of the day, if we put everybody on UBI too, like, and then everyone gets laid off from their jobs because, you know, it becomes socially acceptable to do so, they mean at the end of the day, we're just shifting again the same the same people who are on welfare because they're underpaid at Walmart are going to be still underpaid with whatever UBI they have. And we're basically shifting the blame again off companies and onto the like taxpayers.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a really, I don't know, it's just a disingenuous conversation when you're having it, because at the end of the day, why isn't it that banks are deferring loan payments right now or doing these types of things that can, you know, help shift the money? We're just paying it from a different position, right?
Exactly.
So I think UBI has to be done in a way that maintains kind of the systems that we have in place before it can be kind of a real discussion.
And it's, as if it's used in conjunction with other methods of making sure that people are able to meet the needs, that the basic needs that they have in life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like you said, like, where does the money come from? Like, I think one of the elements that we're seeing right now that is maybe a more radicalizing part of this whole experience is that, you know, we're realizing how much power the state actually does have to take hold of things and to control things and to demand things mm-hmm. of business or of society that is often just denied by the people, you know, the bureaucrats or the politicians during the normal goings-on of our politics. But we're realizing now, like, okay, well, so the state, you know, mayors and governors and people like that are able to say there is a moratorium on evictions. There is a moratorium on payment on this debt. The Fed was able to come up with $1.5 trillion out of nowhere to put it into to Wall Street to stop the free fall mm-hmm. that was happening a few days ago. So it is radicalizing for people to see, like, okay, well, that can happen. Like, that is something that our leaders are able to do. Like, we are able to, when faced with a crisis, the question of where does the money come from is not real because it can just happen.
I mean, we saw, I think it was last week, Governor Brown and Ted Wheeler at that press conference, they basically stated that water won't be shut off for anyone who can't pay. I forget the timetable that they set.
Yeah.
But basically, during this event, they are not going to shut people's water off, even if they can't pay it, because they want them to be able to still wash their hands and do all the things, right? And obviously, that's something that I think you know, made a ton of sense, and they were able to act quickly on it. And we just don't see it. Yeah, it's creative. It's an interesting solution to some of the problems that I think people are facing, especially people who are not being able to work anymore. And so I think more stuff like that, the government being put in a position to take actions to help people who are, you know, getting the bare minimum treatment from their companies.
Yeah, another example of that is like hotels are losing business right now because no one is going to go travel and no one's going to stay in them. And so a lot of cities and municipalities are housing their houseless populations in these hotels. They are just putting them up. And it's like, okay, if we can do that in the moment of a crisis, I think that makes us reimagine what is possible in the larger crisis that is everyday life for a vast majority of Americans, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's a larger discussion for another time, but this is a very interestingly radicalizing moment that I think will come out of this on the other end, and people's imagination for what is possible will be a lot broader. Yeah.
And I think, too, one thing I really want to implore our listeners is that the government has a harder time helping you if they don't know you exist.
Right.
And so the census has been going out for the last couple days, and I believe it should be delivered by, I think, the 20th is the last day that they're sending all these invitations out.
Yeah.
And I please implore everyone to take the census so that, you know, your county and your state gets the representation and also the funding that it needs.
Absolutely.
A lot of particularly minority-based communities, people don't want to take the census for obvious reasons. And, you know, we could get into the politics, but I believe there was a citizenship question added to this
threat of that
census.
Yeah.
So please, I want to just make sure that everybody is kind of aware that it's going on and to take it to make sure that, you know, your area and, like I said, county gets the funding and everything that it needs, especially during this kind of crazy time.
It is one of the most important things moving forward for the next decade to make sure that the services and the representation is provided for the population that exists. And if, you know,
and the government can't do that if they don't know.
Exactly. Like, this is their way of finding out. So even during this crisis time, it is important to make sure you fill that out and respond to the census.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we are running up against the end of time or the end of our show time here, I just wanted to say that the congressional Democrats did pass, and in conjunction with a large portion of the congressional Republicans, they did pass a paid family sick leave bill. To deal with this crisis, like a relief package for the COVID-19 crisis. Mm-hmm. But based on the demands of the minority, the Republicans, the Democrats led by Nancy Pelosi left in a loophole, which essentially meant that only about 20% of U.S. workers are actually covered by this, because all companies with over 500 employees are exempt, which includes about almost 60% of American workers are exempt from this. And the hope was that these big companies would just be sort of feel impassioned enough to provide sick leave for their employees, but there is no mechanism to make them do that. And in fact, the New York Times opinion page, which is not notoriously left-wing at all, called this, they said that the House's failure to require universal paid sick leave is an embarrassment that endangers the health of workers, consumers, and the broader American public. So if you're getting called out by the New York Times opinion page as a Democrat for from the left, then that's a pretty big indictment of what just happened. And one other funny, this is more of a funny anecdote than anything else, but obviously this crisis has shown bare the failings of our healthcare system to take care of basic people, you know, the needs of basic people, or working people. And it's just funny that it came out yesterday that the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs sent a recommendation out to Norwegian students studying abroad that they should return home immediately, especially if they are studying or living in countries that with poorly developed health services and infrastructure and or collective infrastructure, for example, the United States. They highlighted specifically that Norwegian students living in the United States are living in a country with underdeveloped healthcare systems, and that they should return to Norway that has a fully functioning social healthcare system. So I think if that isn't a full-on indictment of what is happening right now, then I don't know what else is. So we have about a minute left in our time here. I think that, you know, this obviously has been a we could talk about this for another hour or so, and we will likely be talking about this on next month's episode too, simply because I don't think this is something that's going away very quickly. But you know, this is the major impact on workers is going to be felt. The ripple effect is going to be felt for a long time. People getting laid off, furloughed now, you know, having to eat into their savings to handle not being able to get paid.
Yeah,
all those things are
a lot of 401ks.
Exactly. Yeah, don't look at your 401k right
now.
So anyways, I think that this will be, whether or not it relates to electoral success and the Democratic primary and things like that, I think this will be a radicalizing moment for Americans and the world at large about the systemic change that needs to take place in order to make sure that our society is working for working people and the vast majority of us. And hopefully we can build off of this and find some silver lining in this crisis.
Yeah, everybody stay safe. Please go to census.gov to take part in the census, or to type in your information that you received for the census. And please remember to try to social distance as much as possible. Work from home if available. Yeah, wash your hands. And to make sure that you limit the spread of misinformation.
Yes, indeed. Very important. Well, everyone out there, thank you so much for listening. Stay safe.
Yep.
We will come to you again next month. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Yeah, until next time, stay safe.
Thanks.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is day 4 of our partial station shutdown on the COVID-19 occurrence. We are about to go to Prison Pipeline, coming up right next.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight we're here with Daniel McGowan. How you doing, Daniel?